Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter Jr. and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Mario Ritter Jr.
Vietnamese women in and around Seattle are making face masks for healthcare workers who face a shortage of protective equipment in Washington state. Katie Nguyen is a tailor from Spanaway, Washington. She decided to start sewing masks when state officials ordered non-essential businesses like hers to close. The order was part of the public health effort to contain the new coronavirus. Now, with the help of a few volunteers, Nguyen has made thousands of masks. Phuong Vo works in the pharmacy at Evergreen Health Medical Center in Kirkland, Washington. He received about 200 masks directly from one of the volunteers, Luan Nho, a few days ago. Vo estimates he and his co-workers use about 20 masks a day. I showed the masks to my supervisor, who said perfect, he told VOA Vietnamese. Vo added he and others at the pharmacy are required to wear masks and are so grateful for the cloth mask donation. Our Evergreen Hospital is the most crowded with COVID-19 patients in the state. Washington has suffered more than most states from COVID-19, the disease caused by the coronavirus. The first COVID-19 case in the United States was confirmed there on January 21st. The patient had recently returned from Wuhan, the Chinese city where the virus was first identified last year. The first U.S. COVID-19 death took place in Kirkland, a city near Seattle. One day later, Washington Governor Jay Inslee declared a state of emergency. The virus spread at a speed that would surprise many people. As the crisis grew, Katie Nguyen and her friends cut pieces of cotton cloth and sewed the pieces into face masks. We have answered pleas from hospitals, doctors, and nurses who are so desperate for personal protective equipment amid the coronavirus pandemic, Nguyen told VOA's Vietnamese Language Service. She turned the workshop in her home into a mask-making center that followed health guidelines for social distancing. Members of the Vietnamese community dropped off supplies, and friends in Vietnam sent fabric. Volunteers who did not know how to sew came here to learn, and later they did it on their own at home, Nguyen said. Late in March, she told the volunteers to stop working in her home because of Washington's stay-at-home order. The volunteers continued sewing and making masks, but from their own homes. Luan Nguyo and Anne Lam, both from Seattle, lived together and continued to sew together. "We're still healthy. We need to do something," said Nguyo. "A mask is still better than nothing, right? And our doctors, nurses, and healthcare workers are on the front lines of the battle." "I delivered masks to Valley Medical Center in Renton," Nguyo told VOA. "Sitting in my car with masks on my hands, I cried when I saw medical workers and ambulances." She said, "These workers are the most likely to get infected." 2 weeks ago, Lam set up a Facebook page so Vietnamese women could share information about where to get fabric that can be used for hospital masks. Now, Vietnamese volunteers in California, Texas, Oregon, and Georgia are sewing masks. "My neighbor and I have made over 200 masks so far," said Lam, who came to the United States from the Mekong Delta area. "I feel happier to know that healthcare workers wear my masks," Lam told VOA while operating her sewing machine. Nguyen said that she and her group have made and donated more than 10,000 face masks. She added that as long as the supplies keep coming, the group will keep sewing. "We may stop when hospitals in the region receive enough masks from the federal government's medical supplies," she said. I'm Mario Ritter Jr.
Millions of people around the world are currently working from home in an effort to slow the spread of the new coronavirus. Many of them have had to learn new ways of performing their jobs while attempting to turn living spaces into work-friendly environments. While such change can be difficult for any worker, it can be even harder for a scientist or engineer who cannot work in their usual laboratory setting. The American Space Agency, NASA, employs a large number of these workers. Almost all of them have been working from home for the past month. Recently, the NASA team that controls the Curiosity Explorer on Mars showed that they were able to perform their daily duties completely from their homes. NASA recently reported on the team's latest activities on its website. Usually, the Curiosity Control team operates from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, or JPL, in Pasadena, California. But for the first time ever, all members of the team have had to do all of their work remotely. Alicia Alba leads the Mars Exploration Program. She said the current situation is very different from the environment her team is used to working in at JPL headquarters. We're usually all in one room, sharing screens, images, and data. People are talking in small groups and to each other from across the room, she said. The Curiosity team has attempted to recreate the same cooperative work atmosphere by using video conferencing technology and messaging apps. Effective communication is very important, so team leaders have added extra planning time each day to help make sure all team members are connected. Carrie Bridge is the chief of science operations for the team. She said one of her main jobs is to be a bridge between the scientists and engineers to make sure they understand each other's work. At JPL headquarters, Bridge usually goes around to meet directly with groups working in a situation room where Curiosity's data and images are examined and commands are shared. Now, she calls into as many as 4 separate video conferences at once. Bridge said she is also now looking at about 15 different message chats at all times to keep effective communication flowing. You're juggling more than you normally would, she said. The remote Curiosity team was lacking some technology and tools they usually use to perform their jobs. Some employees were able to pick up some computer and communications equipment, but other equipment could not be sent home. For example, the team uses special goggles or eyewear to examine 3-dimensional images sent from Mars. The equipment helps scientists get a better look at the surface of the planet so they know where to drive Curiosity and how far they can extend the explorer's arm. The goggles require high-powered computer systems to operate that team members could not set up at home. So, they were told to use simple red-blue 3D glasses instead. While not nearly as sensitive as the usual goggles, the team reported that the low-tech 3D glasses worked just as well for planning drives and arm movements for Curiosity. After a lot of planning and test runs, the remote team was excited to announce that the Explorer had received its commands from Earth and performed as expected. The first result: Curiosity successfully completed a rock drilling operation in an area called Edinburgh. While the effort required a lot of creative thinking and workflow changes, Carrie Bridge said the experience demonstrated what NASA has always been about. We're presented with a problem, and we figure out how to make things work. Mars isn't standing still for us. We're still exploring. I'm Brian Lynn.
Are you at risk of getting seriously ill from the new coronavirus? Here are some things to keep in mind. 80% of coronavirus cases are mild. Young and healthy people are at low risk. Other people and those with serious health conditions have a greater risk of serious illness or even death. If you have a cough, fever, and difficulty breathing, contact the doctor and stay away from other people. For more information, visit the World Health Organization website at www.who.int or the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention at www.cdc.gov.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. We continue the story of America's 42nd president, Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton took office in January of 1993. During his 8 years as president, he appointed more women and minorities to the government than any president before him. He also appointed the second woman ever to serve on the Supreme Court. For the first 2 years of his presidency, Bill Clinton had a Congress controlled by members of his own party, the Democrats. Still, he failed in his efforts to pass legislation to reform the nation's health care system. During the presidential campaign, Bill Clinton had promised to help millions of Americans get health care coverage.
This health care system of ours is badly broken, and it is time to fix it. Despite the dedication of literally millions of talented health care professionals, our health care is too uncertain and too expensive, too bureaucratic and too wasteful. It has too much fraud and too much greed. We must make this our most urgent priority, giving every American health security, health care that can never be taken away, health care that is always there.
He appointed his wife, First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton, to lead a committee to develop the plan. Critics argued that the plan would lead to socialized medicine. In the end, lawmakers decided that the plan would cost too much and would be too difficult to administer. But President Clinton found support on other issues, including crime-fighting legislation. The measure included money for hiring more police officers and building more prisons. Congress also passed his budgets for 1993 and 94 that reduced federal spending. But Clinton's relations with Congress became more difficult after the 1994 congressional elections. The fight over health care and other issues had only led to greater dissatisfaction with Washington. The elections were a big defeat for the Democrats in Congress.
The rising tide lifts all boats, so they say, and the Republicans are sailing right to victory in the House of Representatives. CNN estimating that the Republicans will take more than enough seats to take control of the House of Representatives for the first time in 40 years. And here's what's interesting. It is cutting across all regions. It is cutting across all ages. It is cutting across literally all the candidates.
CNN reporter Frank Sesno. Voters gave Republicans control of both the Senate and the House of Representatives for the first time in 40 years. President Clinton supported welfare reform to reduce spending on public assistance, but he blocked Republican efforts to cut what he believed was too much money from programs including health care for retirees and the poor. Budget fights with the Republican-led Congress resulted in two shutdowns of government operations.
The government is partially shutting down because Congress has failed to pass the straightforward legislation necessary to keep the government running without imposing sharp hikes in Medicare premiums and deep cuts in education and the environment. It is particularly unfortunate that the Republican Congress has brought us to this juncture, because, after all, we share a central goal, balancing the federal budget. We must lift the burden of debt that threatens the future of our children and grandchildren. Unfortunately, Republican leaders in Washington have put ideology ahead of common sense and shared values.
The economy had suffered a recession during the previous administration of George H.W. Bush. After Bill Clinton became president, the economy grew slowly at first, but then recovered more quickly. 1 month into his presidency, Bill Clinton had to deal with a terrorist attack against the United States.
There's been an explosion deep below the 110-story towers of the World Trade Center in New York City.
On February 26, 1993, members of Al-Qaeda attacked the World Trade Center in New York City. The terrorists left a truck loaded with explosives in an underground parking garage.
By early afternoon, Lower Manhattan looked like a war zone. Office workers, faces blackened with smoke and soot, hundreds gasping for breath, staggered into the frigid February air.
The attack killed six people and injured more than 1,000 others. The government later captured those responsible for the bombing. On April 19, 1995, terrorists again struck the United States. Only this time, it was a case of homegrown terrorism. The target was the Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma.
It was an explosion blowing off the entire north face of that building.
The bombing killed 168 people. It was the deadliest terrorist attack ever on American soil up to that time. The man behind the attack was Timothy McVeigh, a former soldier who hated the government. He was captured soon after the explosion. McVeigh was tried and in 2001 executed for his crimes. A friend of his, another military veteran, was also involved in the plot and was sent to prison. President Clinton also had to deal with foreign and humanitarian crises.
A year ago, we all watched with horror as Somali children and their families lay dying by the tens of thousands, dying the slow, agonizing death of starvation. A starvation brought on not only by drought, but also by the anarchy that then prevailed in that country.
President Bush had sent American troops to Somalia in 1992 to assist the United Nations in feeding starving Somalis. Civil war was preventing the people from receiving aid during a drought. In October of 1993, 18 American soldiers were killed in a battle in Mogadishu. It happened during a failed raid on a hotel to search for a militia leader.
This past weekend, we all reacted with anger and horror as an armed Somali gang desecrated the bodies of our American soldiers and displayed a captured American pilot, all of them soldiers who were taking part in an international effort to end the starvation of the Somali people themselves. These tragic events raise hard questions about our effort in Somalia. Why are we still there? What are we trying to accomplish? How did a humanitarian mission turn violent? And when will our people come home? These questions deserve straight answers. Let's start by remembering why our troops went into Somalia in the first place. We went because only the United States could help stop one of the great human tragedies of this time. A third of a million people had died of starvation and disease. Twice that many more were at risk of dying. Meanwhile, tons of relief supplies piled up in the capital of Mogadishu because a small number of Somalis stopped food from reaching their own countrymen. Our troops created a secure environment so that food and medicine could get through. We saved close to 1 million lives. And throughout most of Somalia, life began returning to normal. Nearly a million Somalis still depend completely on relief supplies,
but at least the starvation is gone. And none of this would have happened without American leadership and America's troops. Let us demonstrate to the world, as generations of Americans have done before us, that when Americans take on a challenge, they do their job right.
But members of Congress demanded a withdrawal. A few days after the battle, President Clinton ordered American troops to leave Somalia within 6 months. In 1994, President Clinton sent troops to Haiti to return that country's first democratically elected leader to office. Military officers had overthrown President Jean-Bertrand Aristide 3 years earlier. That crisis led thousands of Haitian refugees to try to flee to the United States by boat. In 1995, American diplomatic efforts, as well as NATO airstrikes, helped produce a peace agreement to end the long and bloody civil war in Bosnia. President Clinton sent American peacekeeping troops to the former Yugoslav Republic. In November of 1993, Congress approved NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. The agreement ended most import taxes between the United States, Canada, and Mexico. It lowered barriers to the flow of goods, services, and investments. President Bush had signed the agreement with Mexico and Canada. American labor unions and environmental groups opposed NAFTA, but Congress approved it, and President Clinton signed it into law. Personal issues from Bill Clinton's past in Arkansas became part of his future as President of the United States. In the late 1970s, he and Hillary Clinton had invested in a land development company in Arkansas called Whitewater. Others involved with Whitewater were in legal trouble by the time Bill Clinton, a former governor of Arkansas, became president. A former judge who owned a savings and loan bank accused Clinton of pressuring him to make illegal loans to help the company. Clinton denied that. And there were questions and accusations about Hillary Clinton from the years when she worked as a lawyer in Little Rock, Arkansas. In January of 1994, after a year as president, Bill Clinton asked Attorney General Janet Reno to appoint an independent investigator. The Attorney General named a Republican, Robert Fisk, to look into the activities of the Clintons. But critics accused him of being too friendly to the administration. In August, three federal judges replaced him with another Republican lawyer, Kenneth Starr. Public opinion was divided about the situation. Some people thought the president and his wife were corrupt. Others thought any accusations of wrongdoing were nothing more than political attacks. Bill Clinton went on to win a second term in the elections in November of 1996. But new issues about his personal behavior would lead Republicans to try to remove him from office.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.